Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present author and columnist Norman Solomon, who talks about what he learned during a recent visit to Afghanistan about the escalating U.S. war there. Larry Burns, director of the Council on Hemispheric Affairs, who takes a critical look at the Obama administration's recent certification of Colombia's human rights record. And Lorelei Kelly, of the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation, who discusses the U.S. role in the upcoming U.N. conference on enforcement of the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Alliance for Green Revolution in Africa was launched in 2006, backed by the Rockefeller Foundation and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Its aim was to promote food self-sufficiency by applying the methods of chemical-intensive farming to the world's poorest subcontinent. Increasingly, environmental critics and indigenous leaders in Africa are complaining about the Gates Foundation's technocratic approach to food security and the damage caused by the Green Revolution in India. According to The Nation magazine, the harm from the initiative includes massive slums created by displaced farmers, growing pesticide use, and falling groundwater levels in areas adopting industrial agricultural practices. The Gates Foundation and the Alliance for a Green Revolution say they have learned lessons from the past and are working to adapt methods to African agriculture. Their new focus is on enhancing small farmers, boosting local seed research, and protecting the diversity of indigenous crops. Green Revolution backers point to the recent experience in Malawi, one of the world's poorest countries. Malawi has boosted food production with increasing use of fertilizer and by applying generous subsidies, but critics maintain that dependency on subsidized fertilizers leave farmers at risk, leading to depleted soil when the subsidies run out. The Canadian firm Hatfield Consultants has found high levels of dioxin, the hazardous agent used in Agent Orange, in people, fish, and soil near the old United States military Da Nang Airport in Vietnam. The environmental study found dioxin levels 300 to 400 times higher than internationally accepted standards. Vietnam says 1 to 4 million people were exposed to Agent Orange during the war. The U.S. military sprayed the herbicide in Vietnamese jungles to destroy vegetation and cover for guerrilla fighters. The study found that 100,000 people who live in neighborhoods abutting Da Nang Airport face a significant health risk from dioxin. The Canadian study called for dioxin cleanup at two other former U.S. military bases in Bien Ho and Phu Cat. The Dalai Lama is planning a November trip to India's disputed border zone in the state of Arunachal Pradesh, the scene of a military standoff between China and India. A spokesman for the Dalai Lama, the spiritual leader for Tibetan Buddhism, says the trip is educational, not political. China does not recognize the current border with India since it was established in a 1914 treaty between England and Tibetan authorities. Chinese troops briefly occupied the area during the short 1962 war between the two nations. Beijing has denounced the Dalai Lama's trip to the disputed area, saying the visit further reveals the Dalai clique anti-Chinese and separatist essence. The Dalai Lama fled Tibet in 1959 after a failed revolt against Chinese-Tibetan rule. Tensions flared between China and India earlier this year when China objected to a $60 million loan for water projects in the province funded by the Asian Development Bank. Over the last year, the Indian military has recorded 270 border violations by Chinese soldiers, and New Delhi has mobilized 30,000 troops to defend its 3,000-mile border with China. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Emily Santos-Poplowski.
Reacting to widespread charges of fraud and ballot stuffing in Afghanistan's August 20th presidential election, the United Nations-backed Electoral Complaints Commission has ordered a recount of votes cast at 10% of the nation's polling stations. Although preliminary results showed incumbent President Hamid Karzai winning 54% of the vote, if a recount reduces his lead below 50%, a runoff election must be held. Uncertainty about the future of Afghanistan's political leadership has been compounded by increased attacks by the Taliban and public outrage at a September 4th NATO-ordered airstrike of two tanker trucks that killed nearly 100, including dozens of civilians. Since being sworn into office, President Obama has almost doubled the number of U.S. troops in Afghanistan from 32,000 to a planned total of 68,000 by the end of the year. Admiral Mike Mullen, chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, recently confirmed before a Senate committee that he expects tens of thousands more U.S. soldiers to be deployed to Afghanistan during the latter half of 2009. Plans to further escalate the war comes as a CNN survey found that 58% of those polled were opposed to the war and 39% in support. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with author and columnist Norman Solomon, who just returned from a visit to Afghanistan in late August. He talks about what he learned on his trip that led him to believe a military escalation of the conflict is a serious mistake.
It's one thing, you know, to see the numbers about how much money the U.S. is spending. I mean, this is our tax dollars. And even last year, $100 million a day from the U.S. Treasury, which is to say taxpayer money, was going to the war in Afghanistan. That number is rising now. It's approaching $200 million a day. And an Oxfam study last year found that 7% of the money going into Afghanistan was for humanitarian purposes, compared to the rest of it, so 93%+ for military purposes from the U.S. And the supplemental bill that went through the Congress, proposed and then signed by President Obama a few months ago for war in Iraq and Afghanistan, provided for U.S. money being spent in and on Afghanistan to be 90% military and 10% non-military. And so, while on the face of it, that is just really a contradiction in relation to the claims that the administration is making about its emphasis on the war, when we were on the ground in Kabul a couple of weeks ago, we could see it in human terms. And, you know, at first glance, it's like, wow, this is crazy. Why can't this wealthy U.S. government take care of these people? And then it sunk in that this war is not about helping people. This war is about winning militarily. And whatever the rhetoric may be, when push comes to shove, when the war is the top priority, that's where the money goes.
What are your impressions of this recent Afghan election, which has certainly been tainted by thousands of charges of incidents of fraud and ballot stuffing and the like? Some very blatant episodes have been described in the press. What does it say about the United States' relationship with the incumbent president, Hamid Karzai?
Well, going into the election, it was clear that Hamid Karzai, as president of Afghanistan, is inept and corrupt. But what now is clear through the election day process on August 20th and the vote counting, or the not vote counting, depending on how you look at it, afterwards and all the ballot stuffing and all the rest of it, is that the Karzai government is illegitimate as well. And that was widely understood by a wide range of people. The U.S. government is really in a bind because, you know, if you look at a book like Descent into Chaos by Ahmed Rashid, the great Pakistani journalist who's covered Afghanistan for three decades, you see the clear documentation that in 2002 the CIA basically embraced and crowned, if I can use that term, Karzai as president of Afghanistan. So he has been the U.S. government's boy over there to run the government, but you might say that good help is hard to find. And so he has not been very satisfying to the Washington elites and the White House, especially in recent months. And it's clear that this year the U.S. government began to look around for somebody else, hoping that Karzai would lose. But he's not losing, partly because he's counting the vote. I think it's clear from the special envoy, Richard Holbrook, and others, while being somewhat joined at the hip with Karzai, they would just as soon throw him under the bus. It's just what do you replace him with? And so I think that helps to explain, A, why there has been so much coverage of the ballot stuffing and rigging in the U.S. press covering the election. And also it helps to explain why there's been a lot of fairly good coverage of Abdullah Abdullah, who is the main rival, the only person with a chance of making it into the runoff. What isn't talked about is that Abdullah is himself a war criminal, a major warlord, somebody who was the disciple of Massoud, the much-loved and by others much-hated Tajik warlord. You know, here we have Karzai, who has embraced people like General Dostum, the Uzbek warlord, himself with tremendous blood on his hands, and the only other person with a chance to be elected now or in the runoff is a guy who's a warlord, Abdullah, with tremendous blood on his hands.
Well, Norman, just finally here, if you had the ear of President Obama after your recent trip to Afghanistan, what's the most important thing that you could convey to him that you think would convince him to change his course in escalating the war in Afghanistan?
I would say that it's essential, if the sources of violence and misery in Afghanistan are going to be changed and reversed, to flip over the priorities of U.S. spending. I would advocate for, instead of 90% military and 10% non-military, exactly the opposite. If 90% of the U.S. spending in Afghanistan were for the purposes of fighting, alleviating, and getting people out of poverty, then we have a real chance both to improve the quality of life in that country and to defeat the Taliban. We forget that the Taliban came into power as an alternative to the corruption of the warlords, many of whom the United States was supporting. So we need to lead morally as well as every other which way. And I would sort of sum it up that in his inaugural address, President Obama said that leaders elsewhere in the world will be judged not by what they destroy, but by what they create. And I think the same standard needs to be applied to President Obama.
That was author and columnist Norman Solomon, executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy and author of the book, War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. Read Norman Solomon's articles online at normansolomon.com. For more than 40 years, political violence has been a fact of life in Colombia, as left-wing and right-wing guerrilla groups have fought the government and each other. The U.S. government, under President Bill Clinton, increased the U.S. role there with the inauguration of Plan Colombia in 2000, at the end of Clinton's second term. The stated goal was to help Colombia fight drug trafficking, which was, among other things, fueling the guerrilla movements. Continued U.S. funding was supposedly contingent on improvements in Colombia's human rights record. That nation is currently the third largest recipient of U.S. foreign aid in the world. In August, the Obama administration brokered a deal with Colombian President Alvaro Uribe to increase the U.S. military presence in his country, much to the dismay of many other Latin American nations. Then, on September 11th, the U.S. State Department certified enough improvement in Colombia's human rights record that it released an additional $32 million to be used to fight gangs and drug smugglers. This, despite the fact that extrajudicial killings in Colombia are still common, including 49 labor rights activists murdered in 2008, up from 39 killed during 2007, but down from the 78 killed in 2006. In June, the United Nations reported that Colombian soldiers had killed hundreds of civilians, falsely identifying them as leftist guerrillas in order to increase body counts. Between the lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Larry Burns, director of the Washington, D.C.-based Council on Hemispheric Affairs. He described some of the background to these two recent developments and what they portend for the region.
President Uribe of Colombia has decided that he wants to be Washington's preeminent ally in Latin America, together with Peru. And as a result of that, he has gone out of his way to accommodate what he thinks are Washington's security needs. What interests Uribe is the drug issue and the insurgency led by the FARC, the leftist insurgency that is decades old in Colombia. Now, this relationship under President Bush, but although it goes back to President Clinton, the relationship has blossomed. And under Plan Colombia, which is a strategic concept that was originally thought up by President Pastrana of Colombia, but significantly altered by President Clinton, and then very much expanded by President Bush. So at the present time, Colombia has received over $8 billion in U.S. military aid, making it the third largest recipient of such aid of any country in the world. That's after Israel and Egypt. The present situation is that the United States resurrected its fourth fleet, which had been demobilized back in 1950. And the fleet was said to be tasked with missions of humanitarian aid, earthquake, and other disaster relief, health, and to project U.S. authority in the region. That last phrase was very ominous. Up to now, not much has been done with the revival of the fleet, but what has happened recently is that Colombia, anxious to come forth with gestures of goodwill towards Washington, particularly since Ecuador, with which Washington does not have a good relationship, has ended Washington's lease on the Manta Air Base, which was used by the United States for anti-drug activities. So the United States felt it needed a new base. So in effect, what it got was the use of seven existing military bases, five of them being airports and two of them being naval bases, which are presently being used by Colombian authorities, but will be significantly expanded now that there's going to be dual use. So we're going to see a significant, although not a vast, increase in the U.S. military presence in Colombia. Still, it will not be more than, let's say, 800 U.S. soldiers and 600 U.S. civilian contractors. But people are worried about not only about where this might go, but they're also worried about what it's going to do to the rest of the region. The origins of what you could see as an arms race taking place with country after country beginning to make these very significant purchases of weapons.
So, Larry Burns, what's your take on the Obama administration's decision that Colombia has made so much progress in improving its human rights record that the U.S. is going to release an additional $32 million in military aid?
I just had a high official of the Colombian government who came to my office to persuade me that Colombia has changed. And the fact is it has somewhat improved, but only somewhat. What we have here is that the United States once again is making a politicized judgment based not upon any kind of scientific merit or even a good counting of casualties that have occurred, but has certainly offended the trade union community in the United States, which was has been waging a very spirited struggle against the entrance into free trade until the murder of scores of labor leaders is ended. Colombia's level of corruption and its human rights violations certainly towers over countries like Venezuela that have relatively benign records compared to Colombia.
That was Larry Burns of the Council on Hemispheric Affairs. Contact the Council at area code 202-223-4975 or visit their website at COHA.org. On September 24th, the United Nations will convene a two-day conference to discuss enforcement of the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. The CTBT prohibits all signatory nations from conducting nuclear weapons tests. President Barack Obama will chair the session, the first time a U.S. president has taken this role. On April 5th, President Obama made a speech in Prague where he declared that the U.S. had a moral responsibility to lead the effort to rid the world of nuclear weapons, as America is the only nation ever to use them. While 149 of 181 nations have thus far ratified the test ban treaty, the United States has not. Obama is now pushing the U.S. Senate to ratify the CTBT before the next nonproliferation meeting in May 2010. However, Republicans have been mostly united in their opposition, making the task of getting the required 67 votes for ratification difficult. One of the most volatile issues in the effort to stop the spread of nuclear weapons is the accusation that Iran is covertly working to develop such arms. Iran, denying the charge, says it is producing enriched uranium in defiance of 5 UN Security Council resolutions to develop civilian nuclear reactors to produce electricity. After many months of stalemate, Iran has agreed to begin talks on October 1st with the United States, France, Germany, Britain, China, and Russia. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Lorelei Kelly, director of the New Strategic Security Initiative, a project of the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation. She discusses the U.S. role at the CTBT conference and the Obama administration's strategy on dealing with Iran.
I think that Obama fundamentally understands that in today's world, power needs to be acknowledged rather than imposed, if that makes sense, that we require that other people are willing to listen to us and perceive us as a legitimate leader, and legitimacy means, like I said, leading by example, being perceived as doing what you tell others to do. I mean, I have a three-year-old, and I learn about legitimacy every single day when I make him eat out of a bowl, and I'm sitting there eating out of the cereal box with my hand. That's my example of the day. It doesn't make sense, and I think that what has happened over the last 8 years is the rest of the world has seen us sort of being judgmental and preaching a lot about these desires and goals, and then on the one hand, and then flouting them on the other, not participating. In fact, standing in the way of some real progress that makes all of us safer. And I think the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, you know, came about in the 60s, and it still hasn't been ratified in the United States. And we are the home we're the home of the deal makers. Americans are great deal makers, and instead of that, we've been perceived as sort of these flagrant rule breakers. You know, we've gone from deal maker to rule breaker in the last decade, and I really think that Obama wants to get that, you know, that status back, that people will take our example and be enthusiastic about it. It'll lead to so many other wonderful things for us in our safety and security if we have some success at these kinds of collective, collaborative venues like the UN's special session. And the fact that our president is leading it is wonderful. I mean, even if it's not as progressive, the outcome is not as progressive as some people, certainly some of my colleagues in politics on the left would like it to be, it's going to be a tremendous step forward. The fact that the United States is participating in a positive way is great.
The Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, what's the importance of it? If it is signed into law in this country with ratification by the U.S. Senate, what will be the positive result in your view?
I think the most positive result for all of us is that it'll really be a shot in the arm for what's called, it's an academic word, but an international regime of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. And this is another one of those treaties from, you know, decades ago that has really stopped, not by power of force, but by power of persuasion, stopped a lot of countries from acquiring nuclear weapons. And this is a long, you know, it's basically a negotiation industry. It's all preventive. It sort of happens behind the scenes.
What is it that the Obama administration can do to really end this very dangerous confrontation with Iran about their nuclear ambitions? And certainly ancillary to that is the implicit threat from Israel that if the United States doesn't act to prevent Iran from building a nuclear weapon, that they may attack Iran's nuclear facilities with just as they did in Iraq many years ago.
Right, and by the way, the attacking the facilities in Iraq has been proven to have not done one bit to make Israel more secure. But back to the larger strategic question of how Obama is interacting with the UN and the rest of the world is different and how it can make us safer with respect to Iran, I think it's actually a brilliant strategy for Obama to go to the UN and say, these are the rules of the road to keep us all safer, and we're back. We're going to be participating. We're going to be taking an active lead. We're going to play by these rules ourselves. And that makes Ahmadinejad look just marginalized and even more sort of a kook, besides this awful result of this election that happened over the summer. And I think that there's a lot of posturing going on right now, and countries say a lot of things in public while there's a lot of other stuff going on behind the scenes to actually create a negotiating framework. And it's my hope that this behind-the-scenes agreement to get back to the table and make some deals and get the Europeans back involved in a really, you know, strong way will result in something. I don't know what it's going to be, but will result in something that gets Iran back into a cooperative agreement that's transparent and accountable. But again, it's hard for the United States because the Non-Proliferation Treaty, what people are talking about is an article that allows countries who are participants in the treaty who've signed up for it to develop peaceful uses of nuclear power, right? And that's the big loophole. The Iranians are saying this is a right. It's for nuclear power. And the whole public and the population there, by the way, really believes in that as well. So you're picking a fight with the whole population when you take on their right to have this, which is a real issue that we need to consider. We just need to put forth these pragmatic steps that reduce the risk. I'm not somebody who stands up and says, you know, ban nuclear weapons forever, because I actually think that, you know, you can have your eyes on the prize, but we can't let that distract us from just taking the necessary steps to reduce the risk. When these neocons say that this is an important, you know, superiority and dominance, it's like trying to answer the question, how high is up? There is no answer to that question, how many? I mean, we have no idea what these weapons could do at this point. The weapons we have today could just completely alter life on Earth as we know it. They're far different than the ones that were used against Japan. I think it's completely irresponsible for people to say things like that instead of offering up problem-solving solutions that, by the way, don't cause the United States to all of a sudden be disarmed or weak or helpless. That's never going to happen. That is never going to happen.
That was Lorelei Kelly, director of the New Strategic Security Initiative, a project of the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation. Contact the center by calling area code 202-546-0795 or visit their website at armscontrolcenter.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Emily Santos-Poplowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.